From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. For International Working Women's Day, we present part one of a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women. At the table and on the menu. Respectability politics and tokenism in genocidal times.
The limited strategies that respectability politics presents to us is not going to get us to a place where the U.S. isn't bombing our homelands, for example, and our families' homelands. Isn't going to get us where Muslim men and boys aren't being imprisoned and tortured.
What is the meaning of hollow so-called inside strategies as Israel's genocide of Palestinians goes unabated?
All of these coalitions are coming together and recognizing that in this moment, if we can dehumanize any group of people at this level, that dehumanization crosses boundaries and borders.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. First, our headlines. As the toll of murdered, missing, and wounded in Gaza tops more than 110,000, a Washington Post investigation revealed this week that the Biden administration has bypassed congressional authorization to send more than 100 shipments of precision-guided munitions, bunker buster bombs, and other lethal aid to Israel. According to the March 6 article, this massive flow of weapons occurred even as the Biden administration has made public statements decrying Israel's indiscriminate attacks, and even though it is illegal to sell weapons to any country blocking U.S. humanitarian aid. Biden made no mention or reference to this controversy during Thursday night's State of the Union address. Meanwhile, the United States is increasingly isolated as Israel continues its genocidal blockade of food and medicine into Gaza, starving the population and shooting to death men and boys who gather around the few trucks allowed to enter. Because of the imposed famine, South Africa returned to the International Court of Justice on March 7th, asking the court to impose new provisional measures in the genocide case against Israel. Keeping up protests against the apartheid state, a new permanent encampment is set up outside the Israeli embassy in Northwest D.C. as the scene begins to resemble the regular protests during the 1980s held outside the South African embassy during the anti-apartheid struggle. As thousands protested outside the embassy on Saturday, March 2nd, I spoke to Hazami Barmada, an organizer of the permanent vigil outside the embassy. She also spearheaded the permanent protests outside the Virginia home of Secretary of State Antony Blinken that is dubbed Kibbutz Blinken.
Okay, I'm here with Hazami at the Millions March for Palestine rally. And Hazami's been instrumental in getting the Kibbutz Blinken set up in Virginia. And so tell me, just first give me your reaction to this turnout today and, you know, the people coming out today.
I think it's important to continue to come out consistently and to continue the endurance in the movement. The occupation forces, the U.S. government wants us to burn out, wants us to get bored, wants us to move on, and we are not moving on. We are now months in, and we are still filling the streets of Washington, and we will continue to fill the streets of Washington. We will continue to expand our work, and we will continue to remind them that people are not okay with business as usual. So it's really inspiring to see this many people come out, and we hope people will continue to come out until the atrocities end, until the occupation ends, and until the U.S. stops normalizing state-sponsored violence.
So the Kibbutz Blinken is more than a month now, right? 34, 35 days. It's really gotten a lot of worldwide attention. I think that you believe that that type of action is, in a way, more impactful to someone like Blinken than the marches.
I mean, I think direct action has a really powerful role to play. If you study history of Vietnam and various other things, it's literally bringing the issues to the forefront of people's comfort. Blinken goes home. you know, can leave at 5 o'clock, come home to his cozy family. Children in Gaza cannot. Families in Gaza cannot. Fathers in Gaza cannot. Why should he be able to? And so with continued direct action that's daily, every minute of every day, every minute he's in his house, he hears us chanting outside. Every time he leaves his house, he's like, oh, damn, I have to drive through this group of people dumping red blood on the street. Every time he comes home, he has us to greet him. And it's a daily reminder, not only of his failure, but of his inaction, of his inhumanity, and how disgusted the American public is with him and his decisions and his silence, and more important, his normalization. He has been someone who's peddled misinformation and lies. He is somebody who constantly whitewashes Israel's crimes. He is someone who's shown that he does not have the integrity of a diplomat or what we expect of somebody with integrity. And so being there every single minute of every single day is a stark reminder. It also pushes him to start thinking about his own safety and security, and hopefully will make him think a little bit more. We are nonviolent. We are a group of predominantly older women, and it is, you know, hilarious to watch his security apparatus build bigger and bigger fences. He's put so many additional security cameras. They have elevated the walls around his home. He has now federal, the land in front of his property, which was private property, is now considered federal property. It is under federal protective order. We are not even allowed to touch the land in front of his home. They have now changed the draping on all the windows. They have fortified his home, and we literally now say he lives in a cage. And if he feels like he has to put himself in a cage, then good for you. Continue to live in a cage instead of do the right thing for humanity. If that's what you feel is the right response, then you look like a fool, and that's what he's proving.
Thank you.
As the state of Israel continues its genocide of Palestinians, one of multiple genocides happening in the world, a recent virtual panel explored how the same imperial powers are behind multiple situations connecting Palestine with Congo and other countries. Chantal James has more.
A critical seminar hosted by the Yemeni Alliance Committee made links between violence in Congo, Palestine, and Yemen and the involvement of U.S. and Israel, and showed how the collaboration between the two countries has sown global discord. Israel has played a bloody role in the diamond industry that is one factor in Congo's current predicament, as one example. Genocide in the Congo, driven by forces of neocolonialism, has displaced over 6 million people there up to this point. The toll of the genocide that has brutalized Gaza, fueled by U.S. tax dollars, rises daily, and the U.S. empire has spread its military aggression to Yemen by attacking the already heavily besieged country with severe strikes that continue in retaliation for their opposition to the Palestinian genocide. Human rights activist Kambale Musavuli was a panelist on the Democratic Republic of the Congo and offered historical context on relations between Israel and Congo. During the time, Congo was called Zaire.
Zaire, at the time, was the first African country to close the Israeli embassy. The reason why they closed the Israeli embassy was around Mount Sinai, that Israel decided to take over Mount Sinai. And Zaire at the time had military cooperation and commercial cooperation with Israel. The president of the Congo back then, a dictator, had still an ideological or a principal position that he decided as a president of that time. He made a very long speech at the UN. But there are a few things that he said in there. He said, between a brother and a friend, the trust is clear. I announced today that we are closing the Israeli embassy and closing all ties with Israel, because they infringe on the territorial integrity of Egypt of the time, and that was a way to pressure Israel. After the closure of the Israeli embassy at the time, over 12 African countries followed suit after, which was a form of pressure, diplomatic pressure, that was put to bear on Israel, which let go of Mount Sinai.
The panel used moving testimony and analysis to make clear that the networks between massacres committed in these three different countries are linked, with the United States and Israel being a common denominator. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James.
In local news, D.C.'s new so-called crime bill, the controversial Secure D.C. Omnibus Amendment Act, was passed by the D.C. Council on March 5th. The new law makes it easier for judges to order pretrial detention, expands the definition of carjacking, and creates a new felony for so-called organized retail theft. aimed at flash mobs that target stores. It also creates temporary drug-free zones and will require DNA collection after someone is charged with a violent crime or sexual assault and a judge finds probable cause to have the DNA collected. And finally, there are actions around the world to shut it down for Palestine on March 8th for International Women's Day and on March 13th. To see a list of all actions, check out shutitdownforpalestine.org. And those are headlines and happenings. Up next, our discussion for International Women's Day on how respectability politics is hurting the movement for change and social justice. Stay with us.
صباح الخير يا ولاد عمومنا تفضلوا شرفونا شو بتحب مضيفكم دم عربي ولا دموع من عيوننا بعتقد هيك تأملوا نستقبل من هيك تعقدوا لما تدركموا على غلطة من هيك لبسنا الكوفي البيضة والسودة صاروا كلاب الزمان يلبسوها كموضة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونها كوفية عربية بتضل عربية حطتنا بدنا إياه ثقافتنا بدنا إياه كرامتنا بدنا إياه كل شي إلنا بدنا إياه ما رح نسكت لن نسمح لن ليك ليك لا بقلن يسرقوا شغلي مش إلهن ما خصن فيه بلدونا بلتبس لبس من هالأرض بتكفي هنش طمعانين عالقدس قدس اعرفوا كيف تكونوا بشر.
This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, at the table and on the menu, respectability politics and tokenism in genocidal times was the subject of a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women on February 12, 2024. The panel includes Iman Abid, Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, Rama Kudami, Campaign Director at the Action Center on Race and the Economy, Iman Hassan, a civil rights lawyer who directs the Stop the School to Prison Pipeline program at Massachusetts Advocates for Children, and Mariam Durrani, professorial lecturer at American University. The panel was organized and moderated by Maha Hilal, an expert on institutionalized Islamophobia, the war on terror, and counter-narrative work. She is the author of the book Innocent Until Proven Muslim, Islamophobia, the War on Terror, and the Muslim Experience Since 9/11. She is founding executive director of the Muslim Counterpublics Lab. She begins the program.
My name is Dr. Maha Hilal, and I'm the executive director of the Muslim Counterpublics Lab, an organization whose mission is to disrupt and subvert dehumanizing narratives that are designed and deployed to justify state violence against Muslims. I'm also the author of the book, Innocent Until Proven Muslim, Islamophobia, the War on Terror, and the Muslim Experience Since 9/11. I want to welcome you to our event, which is titled At the Table and on the Menu, Respectability Politics and Tokenism in Genocidal Times. And I want to thank our co-sponsors for tonight's event, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and Adela Justice Project. So before I introduce our incredible panelists, I want to offer some framing for tonight's discussion, especially as we continue to witness Israel's genocide of the Palestinians, which has continued unabated for 127 days now. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with the origins of the term respectability politics, it was a term that was coined by Dr. Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham in her 1993 book titled Righteous Discontent, the Women's Movement in the Black Baptist Church from 1880 to 1920. Writing about respectability politics, Higginbotham described it as a political strategy based on the belief that the promotion and adherence to certain behaviors and cultural norms, particularly dominant white values, would enable the Black community to gain equality in society and the legal system, which therefore served and would serve a vehicle for facilitating political and social change within the Black community and lead to the elevation of the community as a whole. During the civil rights movement, of course, respectability politics represented a prevailing tactic. And as marginalized communities adopt strategies for social, political, economic, and legal equality, the beliefs that undergird respectability politics have continued to be deployed, particularly by members, elite members of these communities. In the context of the war on terror and now Israel's U.S.-backed genocide of the Palestinian people, many individuals and organizations alike have turned to this strategy, promoting adaptation and accommodation with the goal of gaining a seat at the table, a seat that has often been proverbial. In the context of Palestine, this has meant the policing of perspectives and repression of strategies and tactics that reject any accommodation to Zionism. Rather than procuring any semblance of equality, respectability politics have been repeatedly used by elite members to gain proximity to power, and in the process of doing so, undermining the humanity and dignity of the communities that they are theoretically advocating for. Immediately after the Hamas attacks on Israel that were launched in response to Israel's brutal and ongoing occupation and apartheid of Palestinians on October 7th, Israel began its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians. Of course, the United States, in its unwavering commitment to Israel, has continued to support Israel. In the meantime, members of the Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim communities have engaged and continue to engage with the Biden administration. One of the earliest meetings, at least that some of us know about, was at the end of October, when a handful of Muslims met with the Biden administration in the beginning of this escalated violence and genocide. One of the participants who was in attendance at the meeting in October with the Biden administration was a leader named Rami Neshashibi. In an NPR article where he was interviewed about the meeting, he said that although he was not at liberty to divulge exactly what was said at the meeting, that he was, quote, nevertheless, pleasantly surprised by the president's ability to absorb the very direct criticism. Another attendee at the same meeting, who chose to remain not anonymous, stated that Biden was, quote, very empathetic to our concerns. And yet another individual said that Biden, quote, made it very clear that his administration is working very hard to avoid escalation. In a closed-door meeting just last week in Michigan, Deputy National Security Advisor John Feiner told the Arab and Muslim community leaders who were in attendance that, quote, we have left a very damaging impression based on what has been a wholly inadequate public accounting for how much the president, the administration, the country values the lives of Palestinians, and that the Biden administration was, quote, very well aware that we have made missteps in the course of responding to this crisis. The use of missteps should be recognized for what it is, a violent euphemism that completely erases the full-throttled support of Biden and his administration for Israel's genocide in the form of unlimited funding, weapon sales, and rhetorical gymnastics. It bears noting, of course, that we can attribute this meeting to nothing other than the Biden administration's desire to obtain the community's vote. A few months ago, I had a debate with a Muslim working with and at the State Department on human rights in the Middle East, and his evidence of success in terms of how Muslims in government were able to make change and why representation was important. He gave the example of the State Department's announcement in December that it would impose travel bans on extremist Jewish settlers who were implicated in attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Of course, this announcement represented absolutely nothing serious in the way of curbing Israel's genocide, and was demonstrative of the U.S. government's crumb-throwing towards members of the Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim communities. It also reveals the perils of tokenism, particularly where those who allow themselves to be tokenized actually believe in this strategy as a path to change, which serves to uphold the status quo. Of course, there is much more that can be said about these backdoor discussions and meetings that continue to be held, including listening sessions on Islamophobia. While certain elite members of the Palestinian Arab and Muslim communities continue to engage with the Biden administration on the basis of the idea that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, our conversation today will directly challenge and confront this notion and highlights what happens in the absence of real political power, that you can be at the table and on the menu at the same time. More proactively, our panelists will also discuss what it means to engage the government on our terms and how we can build political power that is based on and rooted in the humanity and dignity of our community, and which is built on our categorical, not negotiated rights. While Israel continues its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians, and as we continue to demand a permanent ceasefire, nothing could be more important. So I want to introduce our exceptional and amazing panelists who will be guiding us through this discussion. And I'm going to give you their top line bios because we have a lot of things to discuss and not a lot of time to discuss them. So first, we have Iman Abid, who is the Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Next, we have Rama Kodemi, who is a campaign director at the Action Center on Race and the Economy. Then we have Iman Hassan, who is the director of the Stop the School to Prison Pipeline program at the Massachusetts Advocates for Children. And last but not least, Dr. Maryam Durrani, who is a professorial lecturer at the School of International Service and a faculty affiliate with the Anti-Racism Research and Policy Center at American University. I want to give our incredible panelists a chance to open our discussion with some introductory remarks. And I'm going to ask them to frame their remarks through the lens of the following question. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and the ways that respectability, politics, and tokenism have shown up? So we'll go to Iman A first, followed by Rama, followed by Iman H, followed by Dr. Durrani.
Yes, thank you all so much for joining tonight. I feel very honored to be amongst this panel. For Dr. Mahalal for putting this on, I really just appreciate all the support and efforts being put into this conversation. And specifically in this moment, I think I would be merely missing out on an opportunity if we didn't discuss at any point what had just happened on, you know, what unfolded in Rafah as a great American football game was just about to begin, which is just an epitome of American capitalism and imperialism all in just an hour of an evening. And the loss of over 100 lives in just that time span of the game itself. So I think that this conversation becomes that much more important in this exact moment. But to provide a little bit of background on myself, I am, as Maha mentioned, I am the Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. But I'm also a daughter of Palestine. I am a Palestinian with Palestinian parents, a Palestinian mother who lived under occupation for over 30 years. So while we talk about occupation through this lens of systems and the way that we have unfolded to see it today, I want to help remind folks that oftentimes it also shows up in an everyday basis. And there's just been, for the last 31 years of my life, I've really been working to unpack just how living under occupation, specifically with a mother who lived under occupation, how it's shown up. And there are just so many ways in which it has integrated and shown up through so many microaggressions on the daily in my upbringing here in the West, and just the deep contrast of values and principles that my mother raised me with and what I was told to have here in the West. And I think it kind of shaped my perspective on the work and my understanding of what it meant to be a Palestinian in the diaspora, and understanding just how my experience differentiated from those who live under occupation. Even though our blood is all the same, our experiences are not still the same. And so as I further entrenched into that understanding, I had carried along this duty, this responsibility that I felt that I had to support my people in any way that I could. And so for me, it became a part of making sure that I stuck to principle and value in the work that I was committing to. But, you know, surprisingly enough, I actually didn't spend as much time in my work on specifically on Palestinian organizing. Before joining the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, I spent a lot of time actually doing other types of work in the civil liberties and civil rights space. As someone who has worked for the ACLU for 7 years prior to joining the U.S. campaign, you know, spending a lot of time community organizing in our own localities. And long before moving to D.C., getting the opportunity to speak to the people in New York and upstate New York in particular, which is a large migrant community, a large Black community, a large Indigenous community, of whom had almost every single facet of their liberties and rights being violated in some way, shape or another. So dedicated a lot of time to that and understanding just what it is that I could do in contributing to the work around us specifically. And in my role here at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, as part of our organization, I mean, the mission of the organization itself is dedicated to helping folks understand how the United States has played a vital role in upholding the military funding that gets sent to Israel. And the main intent is to try to bring an awareness to the American public, specifically those here in the West, and understanding just what role we have to play in what happens 5,000 miles away. One of the biggest questions that we ask ourselves every single day, or people ask of us, you know, those who perhaps are naive or not sure of why Palestine needs to be at the forefront of their minds, this is an angle that we have taken as an organization to help bring attention and kind of shift people's minds and perspectives on the issue. And so through that, we have drawn up programs and different educational initiatives and national campaigns, localized campaigns, to try to bring up that awareness in some shape or another, while also making sure that we are moving towards ending all forms of U.S. military funding to Israel. So it's been really important for us to kind of stand true in our principles and values as an organization. I feel very fortunate that where we stand as a campaign alongside in the movement is a place of true radicalness and a place of true revolutionaries, people who stand on the right side of history in many, many moments, if not all moments, in trying to do our best when it comes to seeing these social justice violations happening left and right. And so for us, this idea of respectability is defined by also sticking true to our principles and values in the work that we align with. And so I think leading up to this moment that we have witnessed now for the last 4 months, we are now 4+ months of this genocide that we've watched unfold in Gaza. We've had to kind of decide for ourselves, how do we make sure that we as a United States Western organization, a Palestinian-led organization, how do we stand up and make sure that we're committed to the values we have long been committed to in this, and not compromise on what it is that we've been asking for, no matter how difficult the situation has become on the ground. And in fact, taking this moment and finding an opportunity for us to stick so true to our values that some might call it radical, but I truly believe it's just what's morally needs to be done. And how do we make sure that we as a movement partner ensure that we do our best to uphold the demands of the Palestinian people, not just here in the West, but those who are also living in Gaza and the West Bank, and many of us carrying our own families in the back of our minds as we think about that. And how do we make sure that we do our best to understand that the Palestinian community is not a monolith, but also carries a very clear set of demands towards its own, you know, idea of liberation. And one of the things that I want to acknowledge is that our role has also been about ensuring that when we discuss what Palestinian liberation looks like, it's informed by Palestinians alone. And that we as an organization, as a Palestinian-led organization, are used as one of the many that exist here to help uplift those demands and ensure what it is that, you know, ensure that we are actually building up what it is that Palestinians themselves want versus perhaps what other allied groups may be asking for in this exact moment. And for many of us, we also know that Palestine is used as a litmus test. There are many who are afraid to step up and to show up, but we feel very fortunate to be in a space as an organization to kind of stand true in our radicalness, true in our principles, true in our demands, and not have to compromise in these moments of despair just to kind of, you know, grab the bread, the little crumbs of anything as we're asking for. But to rather really lean in this moment and ask for everything that it is that we could use in this exact moment to ensure that the Palestinian people receive the ceasefire that they deserve in Gaza. And more than that, right? Like not stop there, but use this opportunity to build on more on that. And I'm excited to talk more about that here. And an understanding as well that there are many well-intentioned people out there, many well-intentioned organizations and allies, but we Palestinians know best. for what it is and how we define our own liberation. I find it quite, perhaps being Palestinian, the non-identified group, the group that's actually most impacted, that gets asked the least about what it wants and what it needs. And so as a 20 plus year organization, working our best, trying our best to ensure that if it's not a Palestinian themselves that's saying it, you probably shouldn't be listening to them for what the solution should be. And I think that that conversation is already being forced to be had. I know, Dr. Maha, you had mentioned a couple of the meetings that have already happened. But I also want to think further. Oftentimes we get told we have to work within the foundation of the supposed, you know, future peace deals surrounding this framework of the two-state solution. But in reality, is that really what Palestinians have wanted and asked for? Or is it just what we're being told to pursue? And so I think that those are the big things that we've been encouraging folks to ask themselves as they potentially start to propose solutions in the very near future, post-ceasefire and post what's happening in Palestine. But, you know, highly always encouraging folks to look to Palestinians and the Palestinian movement itself in this exact moment.
You're listening to the panel At the Table and On the Menu, Respectability, Politics, and Tokenism in Genocidal Times, a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women that was held February 12, 2024. Sponsored by the Muslim Counter Publics Lab. The last speaker was Iman Abid, Director of Advocacy and Organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Up next is Rama Kudami, Campaign Director at the Action Center on Race and the Economy. This is On the Ground. I'm Esther Averam. Stay with us.
نحن مهد الحضارة تاريخنا وتراثنا الشاهد على وجودنا من هيك لبست الثوب الفلسطيني من حفا جنين جبل النار إلى رام الله خليني شوف الكوفية البيضة والحمرة خلينا نعليها لفوق بالسماء أنا هشاه دية العرب الثاني بخص غزة الثاني بهز هزكلي ماتي حرب سجل أنا شادية منصور والحطة هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لك أنا تربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرب بين لغتين بين بخيل بين فقير شفت الحياة من الشقتين سنة مثل الكوفية كيف ما لبستوني وين ما شلحتوني بدلني عأصولي فلسطينية من هيك لبسنا الكوفية لأنها وطنية
My name is Rama. Thank you all for joining us today. And I know we're going to mostly focus today on engagement with the U.S. government and kind of what respectability politics means on that. But I did want to kind of give my background because I actually do a lot of corporate accountability work, which I think also we see sometimes this respectability politics show up in. So in my current role, I focus on corporate complicity in Islamophobia. There's this project at Acre that we run alongside our partners, Little Sis and Empower Change. And we talk about how corporations help fund anti-Muslim Islam institutions and politicians, how they help spread anti-Muslim propaganda and disinformation, particularly through social media platforms, and how corporations profit from anti-Muslim violence. And oftentimes what we see is these same corporations profit from atrocities across the globe, whether it's here in the US or abroad. I've also done a lot of boycott and divestment work, BDS work in support of demanding corporations and their complicity in Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people. And I think the same way that government officials and agencies choose which Muslims they will and will not engage with, the same applies to corporations. So that is one way we see in terms of who gets to set the agenda for what corporations decide is and is not important, and what then it means for corporations to make amends for the harms they do inflict on our communities. And again, because we live in a very capitalistic society, we know there is this engagement between corporations, between elected officials, in a system that ends up hurting all of us. And that's why part of, I think, when we talk about the need to go beyond respectability politics, is because respectability politics keeps us from actually talking about the systemic problems that are happening and the systemic nature of what we need to do in order to truly all be free. So I'll take one example of social media platforms that have inspired anti-Muslim attacks, like YouTube did with the Christchurch massacre back in 2019, or how Meta now today through Facebook and Instagram is censoring Palestinian activists. And so for a lot of people, when they engage on corporations, they're like, well, if you hire more Muslims, or if you hire, or if you create, make deals with more Muslim content creators, that's a great way for your corporation to help support our communities. But if that's happening, but that's not actually changing the reality that the business model these social media platforms rely on is meant to keep people engaged by watching and liking and sharing propaganda against our communities, then that other stuff isn't going to really matter because the business model is the same. Or think about how many corporations in 2020 came out and supported the No Ban Act, which was the congressional attempt to limit the ability of presidents to impose things like the Muslim ban that Trump had imposed. That included Airbnb. Well, Airbnb, for example, profits from listing properties based in Israeli settlements built on stolen Palestinian land. Or Twitter, now known as X, that helped spread the right-wing propaganda that led to something like the Muslim ban. Or Uber and Lyft, who back in 2017 had actually continued to operate even as taxi drivers went on strike during the many, many airport protests that happened at the time of the ban. So what does that mean when we say that there's certain things that we want these corporations to do, but meanwhile, they are continuing to harm our communities in very, very obvious other ways? And then what are the strategies and tactics that are considered acceptable for our communities to partake in when making demands of what needs to happen in order for us to all be free? And I think there is this larger conversation also around how we set ourselves up many times in our communities, particularly those of us who are the immigrants or the children of immigrants, in terms of, well, quote unquote, model minority, we contribute to the economy. Just think about, again, the conversations around the Muslim ban that happened of just like, well, we want to welcome these refugees. We want to welcome these immigrants because they are worthy, because they can provide, you know, all of these skills and all of this support for the economy. And it's, again, it's very much done in terms of capitalism, in terms of the system that's actually in place. And what do we do to move away from that in terms of humans are worthy of safety, period? It doesn't matter what they can and cannot contribute. And so just like wanted to, you know, add this other lens of how we think about respectability politics. It's not only necessarily about the elected officials, our role as voters, our role as citizens, but also our role as consumers, as investors, of people who partake in capitalism in general, and how we can expand also the framing to that end. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. My name is Iman Hassan, and I'm a civil rights attorney. And as Maha said in my introduction, I work at Massachusetts Advocates for Children, focusing mostly on disability rights work and undoing any barriers to children's education based on their disability, but also really deeply thinking about the criminalization of children based on disability, based on race, or based on a protected status. We have seen the dehumanization of Palestinian children at a level that is almost unfathomable. There hasn't been work done to categorize children in Gaza and Palestine as anything other as non-humans, because children in particular under the law are a very protected class. We understand that we have a responsibility to protect children at a very different level than adults, if that's in the criminal justice system, if that's during war, or if that's just in general in the social legal system. Unfortunately, what we're seeing right now is breaking our conscience at a deeper level, because as adults or as humans witnessing the atrocities that are in particular faced by children, and such a young group of residents in Gaza, is particularly traumatizing. And as an advocate for children, I've noticed that at K through 12, we've seen a lot of walkouts, and we've seen Gen Zs and Gen Alphas be incredibly impacted by it, because they're consuming and watching the genocide and being traumatized by seeing children that are the same age as they are, suffering the most dehumanizing violence possible. And so what we have seen in public education is walkouts. We have seen an activization of anti-war protests that is akin to the Vietnam War. It's an activization that is even beyond the Iraq War in young folks. And it's really has allowed young adults to deeply think about what US violence abroad looks like and what white supremacy looks like on the ground, with especially young adults that are the same age group as they are. And our work as civil rights attorney, unfortunately, we have also seen the criminalization of students and disciplining of students that are standing up and specifically stating Free Palestine. We have seen students from Minneapolis to Boston being suspended 3 to 4 days or even longer. And we know in public education, that is university level, we have 3-4 Harvard students facing disciplinary charges and potentially being pushed out of the community. Simply for stating that the dehumanization of Palestinian is no longer viable and can no longer be ignored. And so as civil rights attorneys, we have to recognize that the respectability politics is deeply, deeply embedded in the law, right? We have to understand that we need to use the law as a tool and not legitimize it as the only way of understanding our society. For example, we know that United States law in itself is deeply embedded in white supremacy violence. And so if we use that as our moral compass, that allows us really to set the standard where we can disconnect from the humanity of other people. And so especially with the genocide that is ongoing right now, I deeply appreciate my fellow attorneys going and filing lawsuits, if that's international or if that's local on the national basis, everywhere from the Netherlands to the United States, or on an international basis, as we have seen a couple of weeks ago. But what we must recognize is that the humanity that we are losing is so deeply embedded within us that when it breaks us, when we're crying, when we're witnessing, when we're traumatized, when we're different, it's disconnected from what the law is allowing or not allowing. It's deeply embedded within our humanity. And so respectability politics in the law is equivalent to abandoning your humanity and thinking about the law as the threshold rather than what we know is to be true within us as humans. And so the break in conscience is so strong within so many people right now. And if we play within respectability politics, it's the loss of humanity that we really are leaning into.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Hilal, for inviting me to be on this panel and for this opportunity to learn from all of you. So I'm going to answer this question by thinking a little bit about what it means for us to have this conversation here in DC, which we know is one of the centers of US empire. And if we think about the empire as constructed in DC right now in 2024, it's really important that we're moving beyond thinking about US empire as white and thinking about how whiteness is centered without thinking about all the other ways that we are participating and become complicit in the project of producing empire in the 21st century. And so as immigrants who have inherited particular kinds of colonial legacies that often predate us, we know that these inheritances cannot be disinherited. And these imperial and colonial inheritances are deeply bound up in our family histories, both prior to migrating to the US and after. And so I'm saying this all not to indict anyone, but to recognize this need that we have to see how imperialism has shaped and continues to shape our community. And how do we understand the political project that we need to engage in right now in this context? And this is partially to also discuss how my family, like many families, is complicit in empire building and the violence of empire. And because my scholarship is transnational, I want to situate myself both within my family's history before migration and after. And so before 1985, when we were in Pakistan, I have to acknowledge how we benefited from the state as Sunni Muslims in an increasingly anti-Ahmadi, anti-Shia state context, as Punjabis and Urdu speakings in an otherwise anti-Pashtun, anti-Baloch state context, and as dominant caste people in South Asia who had access to healthcare and education. And that by moving to the US, we became complicit in the settler colonial and anti-Black projects that undergird US society and also in US empire and its endless wars. And so in 1985, when my father was working at a gas station and was recruited from there to join the US Army, and we lived as part of the military system for many years, I have to acknowledge how I wish in retrospect that that decision had gone very differently. And that I cannot at this point disinherit myself from this history. My entire primary and secondary education was at Department of Defense schools on military bases. And our education was immersed in imperial projects, which meant, for example, that we traveled for school events into different parts of Germany that were often also military bases. Sometimes I say that I grew up all over, but actually it's a vernacular for talking about US empire. I can say this because it is important. It's very important, I believe, that we reckon with our complicity in these systems and that we reckon how did we get here and how do we get out of these situations? What do we do when we realize that we are directly complicit in these oppressive systems, even in choices that were not our own making but have shaped our lives? And how do we reckon with the violence that we are implicated in? Later, I went on to study engineering at the University of Arizona, and I started writing against the exponential increase in anti-Muslim rhetoric after 9/11 in the college newspaper. That was the beginning of my process of developing a political consciousness. But my writing and student activism wasn't very much connected to the other parts of my life, including on campus. And so later, when I finished my degree, I had the option to go on to doing a master's degree in rhetoric that required $20,000, $30,000 that I didn't have. Or I could take an entry-level position as a systems engineer with a defense contractor. And I'm sorry to say that I chose the latter because I had continued to keep my engineering training separate from my anti-war activism on campus. And I think that compartmentalization is something that we are often taught, especially as immigrants, in keeping our home lives separate from what's happening outside. But in the process, that coping mechanism was actually limiting my ability to learn and understand my position in the world. And so from there, I had to realize, and I wish I had realized earlier, that I needed to leave that job. Within a year, I resigned and I went on to do my master's in English at the University of New Mexico, which turned into an adjunct teaching position. And later, I went on to teach in Pakistan and develop my PhD project, which now is the book that I'm working on, which looks at how war on terror policies and programs have shaped higher education in the US and in Pakistan. And I shared this journey to think about how respectability politics is sometimes something that we are, again, born into, that we inherit as a way of being, and we are indoctrinated into through our educational systems and through the capitalist processes that drive us to find a job, often at the expense of our own humanity. I found that as I was thinking and writing about the war as an undergraduate, I was only capable of what I was learning at that time. And so over the years, I have developed my ideas, I have made mistakes, and I have tried to find community in the wrong people sometimes based on simplistic understandings of shared heritage. Rather than doing this, I have realized now that it is imperative to examine how the war on terror works within higher education. And I have developed this research in part precisely because I grew up on military bases and have been predisposed to seeing how empire operates in plain sight. And so I just wanted to close, because I know we have many other questions to get to, is that respectability politics is something that we often are indoctrinated into through these very systems. And that many times I've now started to see that even as we're talking about anti-Muslim racism and Islamophobia in educational spaces, we are actually becoming complicit in the ways that the university co-opts these movements and uses them for what they are trying to put forward. And so it's absolutely essential that we call this out, especially at this moment, and not fall into these respectability politics ways of thinking that actually are very much at the disservice of ourselves and our communities. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you all so much for your brilliant opening remarks. And, you know, thank you especially to Iman A for reminding us of the need and imperative to center Palestinian voices and Palestinian calls for justice and liberation. I'm going to ask each of our panelists a question based on their experience and also what I know and our relationship, the relationship we've developed. Just to get a deeper sense of how each of them conceptualize this topic that we're dealing with, right, which is respectability politics. So for Iman A, I want to start with you. You have extensive experience as a community organizer, and now as well with your work at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. I'm wondering if you can talk about what it means to influence power from the outside in. And if you could speak to the ways in which perhaps respectability politics have marginalized communities' demands.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think I'll speak to the first part, which is the influencing power from the outside in. Most of our advocacy is done with folks from the outside, folks who have nothing to do with institutions, these institutions of power, folks who are interested in the issue, folks who are organizers across different sectors, folks who are building their own spaces and trying to do the work to further move along the demands of the Palestinian movement. and people come from all different parts of the movement. Not all of us necessarily agree one and the same, but we work with many folks who have tried from the outside to kind of really build their own power, to leverage that. And through those campaigns, we oftentimes convene those groups to kind of do our best to ensure that we're meeting the full demands of the Palestinian movement to the best of our ability, understanding, again, we are not a monolith. We may not all feel the same, but we all recognize that there are enough of our demands that we all align ourselves around and we can potentially move forward on. And so through that, oftentimes trying to figure out what are the different leverages and like what are the different opportunities of power that we have within this mass space outside these institutions of power that we could leverage to potentially encourage those at the top to be convinced of policy change, to be convinced of certain stances and positions that they have taken. And it comes from a deep understanding of community organizers that if we work from the top down, we're not really building power. We're just continuing to reaffirm in the power structures that already exist, but rather working from the down, you know, from the bottom up and understanding that the people themselves have the opportunity and the ability to leverage their own power to be able to make those demands, have those demands met. And really recognizing that we understand that this is long, even the demands that we're asking for across the Palestinian movement are going to outlive us. And I think for many of us, we're trying to think through how do we make sure that these demands and this understanding of why these demands are the way they are understood not only by this movement, but the generation to come after that. And so a hope and opportunity is that we try to build up or constantly around how do we both educate and how do we also build power in the people and in the sectors that are working to organize to be able to leverage the power in the next cycle of organizing. As we all understand, there are many, our ancestors really have built the foundation for us to be able to organize as we have done today. And we know that there are many to come long after us and recognizing all of that. So I think for us, we understand that there's a deep power, long-term power that we get to build if it comes from the outside. But I think that a lot of it has to also come from understanding how the inside works. Who are the people in power? How do they move? What makes them move? And understanding that. And I think we can't necessarily completely deter ourselves away from these institutions of power for trying to influence them and understand that we have to know in some way or another how they work. So there is always this, and I know some of the future questions will include more around that inside-outside strategy. But the reality is that understanding doesn't necessarily have to in any way dilute the demands that we are asking for from the movement's end, dilute the demands of the movement itself, but to at least make us more aware so that we know exactly how to move and what to leverage. The answer to the first part. I think to the second, one of the things that I wanted to mention is how does, you know, respectability politics specifically have marginalized communities' demands. They have. And I think especially when it comes into within the context of Palestine, the Palestinian movement is constantly being attacked, especially, and I you can't talk about the attacks without talking about the weaponization of anti-Semitism and how often easily it's being co-opted. When we have any discussion around Palestine, it almost becomes a discussion of whether or not you're being anti-Semitic. And it's almost this derailing of the movement itself. So let alone that outside vulnerability that we have all the time, that the issue of respectability shows up from within the community at times that could really co-opt those demands in a way that I don't necessarily think ever have to happen. But there is a reality to that all. And I think that there's a recognition here that there are many people in the space. And again, not just particular to the Palestinian movement space, where these issues get in hand and get in the way of us really being able to fulfill our top demands. So I'll end there.
And that was the human rights activist Iman Abid speaking on the panel At the Table and on the Menu, Respectability Politics and Tokenism in Genocidal Times, a conversation between Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian women on February 12, 2024. The panel also included Rama Kudami, Iman Hassan, and Maryam Darami. It was organized and moderated by Maha Hilal, founding executive director of the Muslim Counter Publics Lab. This is part one of this panel presented for International Women's Day. We'll have part two on our next show. And that's it for today's show. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. We're on 24 stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, on all your podcast platforms at On the Ground with Esther Averam, and on our website, onthegroundshow.org. Can let us know you like the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Patreon.com at On the Ground Show. Or I link to every show on my Instagram page, which is Esther_Averam. That's ESTHER_IV like Victor, EREM like Mary. The Free Palestine Movement is continuing with actions around the country and around the world. You can get more information at shutitdownforpalestine.org and at answercoalition.org. The music we played this hour included Kofia Arabia by Shadia Mansour and featuring M1. And our theme music for the show is Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix. I'm Esther Avaram. Until next time, take good care and keep raising your voice. Peace.
On the Ground is a totally listener-sponsored, supported show, and we are in need of your support. If you rely on the show, if you listen to the show, you come to look forward to what we are able to offer every week, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/ontheground show. And you can also give on our website through PayPal or other means if you want to send a check. All that information is there. But please, please support us. I want to thank our supporters on Patreon so much. And for those who are already supporting, if you can tell a friend who you know would love to sign up, we need the support. Patreon.com/ontheground show or go to onthegroundshow.org. Thank you.